change in 2012.
Yeah, you're clear as a bell.
Okay.
Okay, that's better.
That's better. We heard you better.
Okay, so welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is August 25th, 2009, and this is episode 321. I'm so glad that all of you have joined me tonight. And for those of you who listen each week, you realize that I live in New Orleans. This week ends with the fourth anniversary of Katrina, which most of us around here just call the storm, without any other name or designator distinguishing it from lesser events. It was a huge event in this area since it rocked our world in Louisiana and Mississippi, nearly leveling some areas where the storm moved ashore. Lives were lost, property was lost, and everyone felt the ripples as we dealt with one of the biggest natural disasters in modern history. A lot was learned about government response, about how people react, and about what all we can or what all can and will go wrong in a situation like that. Most of all, most of us are hoping that the lessons were learned by everyone. I learned a lot, too, even though I was among the majority that evacuated prior to the storm. I learned that you forget important things like documentation on your pet's vaccinations, birth certificates and other paperwork, bills, account numbers, photographs, all of those things were the things that people needed the most and didn't have. So, in observance of a storm that none of us will ever forget, I'm going to remind everyone, have your documents and photographs that can't be replaced ready to evacuate with you. Have digital scans available to you but kept in another location away from where you live. Don't take things for granted, including the sanctuary of your own home. Just because it stood through Camille or Katrina or whatever storm or event that happens in your area does not mean it will survive the next one. Each situation is unique. Don't depend on the government to save you. Have your own escape plan. Leave early. Don't wait until the last minute, and don't leave valuables in your house for looters, such as jewelry and gold coins. As for things such as televisions and furniture, folks, all that stuff can be replaced. Your family cannot be replaced. Leave it. If a thief needs it that badly, let him or her have it. Staying home to guard your stuff is about the silliest thing I can imagine. Even sillier is dying to protect that big screen TV. So, 4 years have passed, we've seen the Mississippi coast spring back to life, and we've seen New Orleans rebuilding itself, despite itself at times. The wonderful place to live, and what makes it wonderful is the people. And remember that, it's about the people. So moving right along to the here and now, we've got a fascinating pair for guests tonight. I want everyone to welcome Victor and Cooch Daniels, the authors of Matrix Meditations. Victor and Cooch, will you guys want to introduce yourselves to the audience?
Cooch, you first.
Sure. Well, my name is Cooch, and I've been a professional intuitive all of my life, and writing a book on meditation is kind of, it's a work of love, because my partner and I have been doing meditations with different teachers for like the last 30 years. And this is kind of a book to try to help people tap into their own inner resources so that they can find more joy and happiness in their lives.
Uh-huh.
Victor?
And I'm Victor, and I've been actually teaching at Sonoma State University for the past 40 years after being a student at San Francisco State and UCLA and being in the Peace Corps in Chile. And I was the first director of the India Studies program. Nirmal Sundesi had put it together, but didn't want to run it day by day, and asked me if I would. And so I had the wonderful opportunity of many different teachers and gurus coming through. I helped Jakusho Kwan Roshi when he came in, the Zen master at Sonoma Mountain Meditation Center, who put that center together. And we studied for many years with Harish Ohari, who was a wonderful Ayurvedic master from India, and also with Sri Mata Amritanandamayi, the hugging mother, who has thousands of people come by and holds them in her latch and cradles them and has profound remothering experiences. And we put together a unique program of meditation and also what we call a matrix of consciousness, which in addition to having a systematic program of beginning and advanced meditations, also provides a wonderful framework for reflecting on the many dimensions of a person's life.
Okay. Now, if I could get you both to do one little thing for me. You know, living in the South, we tend to talk a little slow. That means our ears get a little slow, too.
All
if you
right.
Talk just a little bit slower, it makes it a little bit easier.
Chia. Okay. Chia. Yeah, Chia. Okay. Mostly me who talks too fast, so I'll slow down.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, we tend to get slow ears. And also, some of the names that you're naming off are a little bit unfamiliar to most of us. So, you know, you wrote this book, and what was the big motivation to even start on it?
Well, we had written a previous book called Toward Amour, Find Love, Sex, and Romance in the Cards, and Cooch was the lead author on that book, and we enjoyed the process of working together on it enough that we said to ourselves, well, what else? We'd like to write another book together. What is it that we both know really deeply and would like to collaborate on? And meditation was that subject, so that's what drew us to writing a book on meditation.
Uh-huh. And I think it's probably our combined efforts and wisdom of many years of our own meditation experiences and wanting to offer what we've experienced to other people to try to just put a little more light on the path of how to find more of what's inside and fine-tune techniques to help people become more able to work on their own path or discover more about their own self. And there's so many things that people can gain through meditation, so we thought, okay, this is a way we can help the planet.
Well, one thing about meditation is that it's not a quick fix. And we all know that we are all kind of conditioned to the quick fix, the fast food, the quick meal, the everything we want to do it in 5 minutes. We want to fix now. And so how do you get people to slow down enough to use meditation?
I personally think sometimes it takes a long time for people to start hearing that there's something good about anything. I mean, even if you're talking about fast food, it might take a person a long time to, like, want to experience it. So if enough people hear the word meditation and they're given tools, at a certain point, they're going to start trying them. So we can't offer a quick fix that somebody's going to jump into maybe, but if they have the book available and it's sitting in front of them, every once in a while, if they open a different page or try a different meditation technique, at a certain point, it's going to look more and more inviting.
That's my answer. And another answer is that actually we do have some quick fixes. We deal with four categories of meditation, which are mindfulness meditation, concentrative meditation, contemplative meditation, and what we've called adventures in awareness, everyday awareness practices. And some of those everyday awareness practices are a person are things that a person who's not quite ready to go into full-fledged meditation can use even without having a regular meditation practice. So we've got the book set up so that anyone can get into it easily, even a non-meditator. And so the quick fixes are there for people who want to use those as a beginning, and then later maybe they'll be ready to use some of the slower fixes.
So it is something that you can use in pieces, and then as you sort of learn to build that foundation, you can build on it more and more.
Yeah,
right,
and a person can also begin anywhere they wish. The structure of the thing is sort of like the ancient Chinese Book of Wisdom, the I Ching. It was Kuch's brainstorm to put it together in that way. So we have a few introductory chapters, and then we have what's called the Matrix of Consciousness, which has 65 cells divided into body, emotions, mind, and action. And a person can look at that matrix, and anything that is a problem that they're interested in, they can go directly to that cell and read what there is to say about it, so that it's very accessible.
Go ahead, Cooch.
Oh, I was going to give one example of a potential quick fix. If a person is feeling some kind of distress or they're worrying about their health, if they went to cell number 42, which is called your inner healing center, and did the guided meditation that is very simple to follow. You don't have to have any experience with meditating, although if you read the beginning of the book, it talks about how to calm your mind before you start a guided meditation. But that meditation, or actually it's more of an awareness technique, if you do the guided visualization and take yourself through this inner voyage following the directions of the meditation, you can really be surprised at answers your subconscious will throw out that you had no idea that were there. So you can actually tap into resources that you don't even know are available. You can do it within 5 or 10 minutes and find answers that might actually give you a quick fix. And I really recommend that one because I've used it myself more than once, and it always comes. It's almost like going to an oracle, except you're using your own inner vision or your third eye as the crystal ball, and you're looking inward to try to get some kind of vision or a word or an image that will give you something for healing. So that would be an example of a quick fix that I'd recommend for anyone and everyone.
I could give another very different example, which we've called emergency meditation, and that's when somebody feels just really totally stressed out and freaked out, and they're ready to climb the walls and don't know what to do, and the situation around them is such that it's just pushing all their buttons. We take the old principle of counting to 10, and on each count, the person pays attention to the actual physical tension in their body. And as they inhale, they inhale calmness, and as they exhale, they let go of whatever physical tension they feel. And do that for a count of 10. And if they need to, repeat it, do it one more time, and doing no more than just paying attention to letting go of that physical tension within the structure of the counting can, just a couple of minutes, allow a person to get hold of themselves when they were having a hard time doing so.
Yeah. And like meditation, right now we have, I know a lot of people that have never been unemployed before, that are suddenly not only having to deal with unemployment, but long-term mm-hmm. unemployment. Mm-hmm. And seeing their financial situation going from secure to crumbling. Right. And they're under a great deal of stress. Many of them are losing their homes, they're seeing their retirement dreams sort of drifting away with sand. And so they're under a lot of stress. I mean, everything is... Some of them really do feel like everything that they stood on is shifting sand, and it's just disappearing. So is meditation
that's because they're right
situation? Yeah, you know, but you know they do. They need to find something else to, I guess, give them back their sense of what's real. I mean,
yeah.
Because you know they're really kind of lost. They've always been, you know, focused on the their financial success, their material goods, and that's gone. You know, it's gone. And
well,
you know, it's
affecting
people that were right.
It's
let's finish.
Pardon me. I'm sorry.
Especially as a lot of people were raised, that's the only measurement of success that they recognized. That's the culture that they came from, was what you had showed who you were. That's not necessarily true, but you've got a, you know, 50-year-old person that's been conditioned this way. You know, it's a little hard to get them to believe it.
Yeah. Well, we have a little slogan that for that deals with that whole situation, which is when you have to go without, go within. And so the if a person starts this book and goes systematically through the cells, they'll find all kinds of things, like there are cells on attitude, there are cells on transformation, there's a cell for each, a cell for loss. Another of the meditations, this is a contemplative meditation that's in the cell for loss after we've discussed the whole area of losing things that you're attached to, involves a person sitting and imagining themselves to be like sitting physically and then imagining themselves to be a great immovable granite mountain. And winds blowing through, and imagining the winds blowing through, and then continuing to sit there, continuing to move, knowing that they're solid and knowing that they can endure this. And it, you know, it sounds like a kind of maybe almost a hokey little thing, but we found that when people do it, that they can, that it really helps them cope with loss, whether it's a financial loss or whether it's a loss of a relationship or whatever. So one of the things that we've tried to do, and this is not like one of those books that just only deals with what's joyful and wonderful in life. We've also very explicitly addressed topics like worry and anger and limits and hang-ups and defensiveness and so on, so that it's both looking at the difficulties in life, including particularly that difficulty that you've described of losing everything and having to start over, as well as the more beautiful and inspiring sides of life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because, well, you know, even those of us who are not losing our jobs, you know, we may be, you know, our job situation may not be ideal. You may be under a lot of stress, you know, where people would normally just look for another job to move on from where they were at. Right now, nobody's moving.
Right.
Everybody's afraid to lose a little slot in life, you know. And so you're having to tolerate things that used to not be in your realm, in your reality. You know, the petty behavior of people at times, or maybe you know, you're working for someone that doesn't have good ethics, and you really would rather not be there, but you're kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I know a lot of people that are in job situations that are less than ideal. But they're, again, like I said, they're tolerating it because they really don't feel they have any choices.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to find some sort of a personal balance away from the job. And, you know, some are more successful than others, you know?
Right.
Well,
Go ahead.
Well, my sense is because everyone is being affected by what's happening in the world, so we're all going through changes together. We're all being instructed by the cosmos that it's time to wake up to a new reality and look at life differently. And part of the test is, can you do this successfully, or are you going to be depressed and on a bummer all the time? And I think our book gives people a tool to work at looking at how they look at the world and gives people a handle on how to have a better attitude or how to see more of the potential that is inside as well as outside, even if they are at a place of loss or experiencing a downside of their finances. Because right now so many people are being shaken up that it's a group consciousness. So anything that's happening on a group level, we're all in sympathy with one another, but we're all being asked by the universe, by the great mystery, to wake up to another reality. So if a person can look at their relationship with the people around them, how can they become happier with what is? Look at the relationship with their own self and what's on the inside, and how to be stronger, how to be happier, how to be more accepting that we don't have control over this crazy world that's outside of us. So growing to being more comfortable, to having more of a sense of personal power in times that are basically disempowering, can make a person really wake up to a reality that makes their world stronger and better, because they have more of a sense of their inner resourcefulness. So it's not all bad.
Go ahead, Victor.
Yeah, the book helps people look at what is it that they have and to develop those inner resources that don't depend on money. Things like inner freedom, things like love in a sense that is not selfish but giving, finding out ways, looking for ways in which a person can serve other people unselfishly that result in feeling good oneself. Having the moments to make contact with other people and with the world around them, with the small little bits of beauty in each moment that are so often overlooked when everything is going well and when a person is successful and doing well and having lots of money. You can take what you've said about people going without and look at the other side of it, which is people who are being extremely successful. And I certainly know of people who have been very successful in life who have said, you know, here I am. I've got all this money. I've got all of these great things. Everybody looks up to me. And I'm living a life that, in a sense, is kind of hollow, in which there's something fundamental that's missing for me. And that person can also use what we put together here as a starting point to look for developing those things that are missing, for developing the sense of self, the moving beyond I've got to be number one toward respect for other people that they might have looked down upon before, and recognizing that, as Cooch says, we're all in this together, that one person is not better than another person because they've got more money or more possessions, etc., which the culture would have us generally believe because that sells products. But it's not the fundamental human reality. The fundamental human reality is that we are each of us one person like another person, and we're all here together, and if we can recognize that and move together, then it provides a foundation that a person can carry with them in good times and in difficult times.
That's very true. That's very true. Yeah, what you talked to earlier about, you know, a period of awakening. I do agree with you on that. Many people are awakening, but some people are bound and determined that they want no part of it. And, you know, personally, I have a hard time. There's some people that I come into contact with that have such a narrow point of view with the world and such a rigid ruler to measure people by. And they tend to be rather cruel sometimes how they judge others. And I find that I have a hard time not letting it bother me.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, is that something that meditations could help me learn to deal with? Because it's really my problem. I'm the only one being bothered, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, it is, and it isn't. Maybe you may or may not be only the one being bothered. There are some people who enjoy and get their goodies from hurting other people or making other people feel bad. And when that's the case, there is the practical in the world kind of thing of how to arrange conditions to make it minimally possible for them to make other people feel bad. But in the many cases where it is your problem that you don't like what another person is doing, then meditation can be, it takes you into a different kind of space. It helps you become a witness in which you stand, in a sense, you learn to stand outside yourself. That's the mindfulness component. And as you stand outside yourself, in a sense, you're able to watch what you are doing as if you were an observer. And the awareness that comes through doing that then allows you to choose whether to go on doing that same thing, whether to go on having those same kinds of emotional reactions, whether to have the same beliefs and attitudes, or to conclude, you know, that's not serving me well anymore. I needed it once upon a time to get through situations I was in, but I can let go of it and I can do something else now. So it creates a kind of space in which instead of your actions and your thoughts and your emotions all being jumbled together into each other, it's like you have a kind of a large pool of consciousness in which you're able to focus on one thing at a time. And as you do that, you can see it clearly, and you can make new and different decisions about it than you've made in the past. Does that help you?
I hope so.
here's one thought I'd like to contribute.
Good, go ahead.
Okay, my sense is meditation is a way to be in the moment more. And when you're more in the moment, you see more clearly what's going on around you and what's going on inside you. And if you're seeing what's going on inside you, you become like, okay, I'm being really critical right now and judgmental. I don't like myself being judgmental, but I think that person's a jerk and they're doing something really abusive and ugly. So you might really have anger that is, you know, you can't just say, okay, my anger is going to go away because I meditate. Because if you have a real sense of something's unfair or something's wrong, the reality is you're going to be upset, angry, and judgmental about the person who's doing the wrong thing. So it's not a quick fix for, okay, you're going to change having judgments. But it can help you, meditation can help you center where you may not get hung up in being angry as much, or you're going to see your anger and realize, well, how is anger going to affect another person's anger? And there's a saying that anger corrodes the vessel that holds it. And when you become more aware of your own mind-heart connection, you don't want to be holding the anger. You don't want to have the negative judgment because you're realizing that's your energy. So why do you want to contribute to having more negative energy? You want to try to release negative and detach from feelings that make you feel bad. And yes, that other person can be a complete jerk, but why do you want to feel bad because that person's being a jerk? Meditation can help you see your own mental patterns more clearly, and it helps you go from feeling anger or judgmental to going, okay, yes, I feel that, but I want to release that and move towards manifesting my own dreams. And maybe my dream is being a loving, non-judgmental person. Or if your vision of truth is that you are angry and judgmental, you can be more accepting of that this is your energy, this is your choice. And if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it the best I can do it, but I don't want to feel stressed, and I want to, you know, I want to have a good day, which might make you change more and be a little less attached to what the other person's doing. And meditation gives us more of a handle of being able to see our own relationship with ourselves, which in turn enables us to see how we relate to others and how much of the energy is our fault or how much are we needing to own what's going on versus what's going on outside of us.
Gia, can I just add a couple of tags to what Kucha said there?
Sure, go ahead.
Assuming that that I get angry at what someone else has done, one of the things that I can do with meditation is that it makes it possible for me, it makes it easier for me to feel, okay, I'm angry, I'm like, I dislike this, and I breathe deeply and go into the place where I'm able to perceive what I'm doing, and one of the things I become aware of is, okay, what kind of muscular tension am I putting into that anger? And I perceive it, that's my body doesn't feel good. I don't like that. I can let go of that muscular tension, and somehow that changes and softens my anger enough that I can work with it more constructively. Another meditation.
And maybe you're,
go ahead.
Well, maybe you're not trapped in the anger as much. You can still feel the anger because it's justified, perhaps, or at least in that moment you feel it to be justified. But maybe if you can tune into a meditation technique or get more into relaxing and watching your own inner process, you're not trapped in the anger. You can see
it more. I can use the anger if I want to. Like it may be, you know, sometimes anger is useful. Sometimes anger is a motive that helps a person do what they. But I would say that that's probably a small proportion of the total time. The other thing that a person might do, we have a meditation that involves noticing what emotional reaction is on the surface, such as anger, and then going beneath that and seeing what's below it. Because emotions virtually always come in pairs or three of them. There's never really one emotion that's alone. If a person is angry, usually what's immediately below it is hurt of some kind. So I can go and see what's the pain beneath the anger. Or it can be the other way around. A person may feel hurt and not realize that she's actually angry underneath that hurt. And so we have a meditation that helps a person sink down to examine what feeling or feelings are beneath the feeling that's up on the surface. And that gives them a fuller and richer experience of the anger or the hurt or whatever, in the sense that that it may give them a couple of arrows pointing to what they can do about it.
Well, you're very right. Hurt and anger, I think, are probably one common pair because, you know, when I think about it, when I'm angry, I may be angry because I did get hurt, or I may be hurt because the person made me angry.
Right.
So that's a pair that I can easily see occurring quite frequently. Because we do have we have different expectations of different people. But I've noticed that over time, certain people, when I have to be around them, I'll come home and I'll have muscle knots on the back of my head.
Right.
You know, obviously I'm not in a real good mood because that tension travels down your neck. It gives me a headache. It makes it hard to turn my head, neck. And that just, you know, and I don't really notice it coming on until I come home and you touch the back of your head and you've got knots.
So we have a practice in the Matrix that involves, when you're engaged in interaction with another person, do a brief scan and note what's going on in your mind, what's going on in your emotions, what's going on in your body, what are you doing, and what are you intuiting. And if what's going on in your body is central, then you discover in the moment while you're with that person how you're knotting yourself up. And instead of having to wait and come home and meditate to get rid of the knots, you can reduce the degree of those knots you're putting into your into yourself right there.
That would be quite useful because, you know, again, you know, it kind of puts a damper on my entire evening because, you know, it takes a while. It took a while for those knots to appear in the back of my head, and they're not going to go away with, you know, 5 minutes of, gee, I'm off work and my, you know, I'm home and everything's fine now. It isn't that easy.
Right. And guess is that when you feel those knots, that it's not uncommon that there's something that you would like to do or say that's not quite at the surface, that you can't quite get a hold of, but that you would like to do in that interaction with that person, and the practice that we've got helps you articulate to yourself, what is that? You might want to say, wait a minute here. I really don't like that kind of direction that you're going, or whatever else it may be, so that you regain your own power. One of the getting yourself all knotted up sometimes is a sign of powerlessness, and so becoming aware of what you want to do but are not doing helps you regain your own power.
And that could be very, very true. I tend to internalize things quite often, and I know that about myself, and so I don't express it in a way that other people notice. So it's things like rashes or not as muscles, things like that. And I'm not the only one that does that kind of thing, because it's very common for people to be
sure.
That kind of internalizing and rather than being confrontational. Because I tend to choose when I want to be confrontational. It's not always productive.
Let me grab that word confrontational. Often it's as simple as saying, well, maybe, yeah, I guess so, et cetera, when what you really want to say is no. And if you're saying yes when you want to say no, you're going to get all knotted up. Guaranteed. And on the other hand, it may be the reverse. You may have past previous conditioning that tells you to say no, when you really want to say, yes, you know, I'd like to try that. And again, you get knotted up because you're doing the opposite of what your conditioned reactions are telling you to do. So you become aware of that in a moment. We actually have one practice in which you actively practice with another person, saying yes if you tend to be a no person, or saying no if you tend to be a yes person, so that you become better able to respond appropriately to what's happening in the moment.
But sometimes if you're responding to a situation at work and your boss is telling you to do something and your gut instinct is to say no, you can't say no. You have to say yes or you could be booted out the door. So
right.
Sometimes we're trapped in emotions that are frustrating because we can't control what's going on outside.
And there sometimes
right.
It's very useful to develop a greater ability to simply be silent in a situation.
Yeah. You know, and often I'll tell myself, you know, this too shall pass. You know, this is only going to last a few minutes. I'm only going to put up with it for, you know, the next 15 minutes. It's over with. You know, and I have learned over time, I used to commit to too many things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would be aggravated because I was stressed out. I was, you know, I didn't have any me time left. And, you know, I learned to say no. Because it became quantity versus quality. And I wasn't getting any quality, and neither was anybody else. So I have learned over time, you know, not, you know, on a personal level, not to make excessive commitments. The work level kind of, you know, I'm probably like a lot of people. You get dumped on, you do what you can do, and then you say, okay, I'm quitting for the sake of going home. And whatever didn't get done, we'll be there tomorrow.
Mm.
And that's stressful in a way, but, you know, there again, that's one of those things that you don't have any much control over. So you just have to learn to disconnect at some point.
Right.
And say that it's not me, you know, that's the work person, and that's not me.
Cell 31 is called Limits, and it deals explicitly with dealing with situations in which, well, this is the way it is, this is as far as I can go, and making my peace with that instead of banging my head against the wall because I can't do what I would like to do and can't.
You know, it'd be so easy for somebody like me to become an absolute workaholic, because you want to finish the job, but you, at some point there you do. You have to draw limits and say, okay, I do need a personal life. I cannot work 100 hours a week and be a nice person. I just
right.
can't do it. And so you do have to say, okay, that's it. I'm going home and I'm going to do something else. Something different. I'm not going to be working.
Right.
And yeah. You know, even if
if we get somebody who's not quite as in touch with that and not as quite advanced in terms of being able to recognize that as you, then they might find that cell 53, moderation, would be very useful for them, because it contains a practice for helping them assess, okay, what's the right amount and what's too much and what's excessive for me here.
if they didn't have the book in front of their nose to open it up and read a cell, if a person thinks about being in that moment and the situation, but focuses on breathing, and breathing in fully and exhaling slowly and just trying to slow down right in that moment, sometimes that can help you see more clearly just in that moment how to move to being more okay and what you need to do to take care of yourself. Breath is very keyed into our reactions and how we feel inside. And if you can pay attention to how you're breathing and slow your breathing, it brings you more into the moment. It enables you to see more of what's going on inside your mind, and it sometimes can help you just in that moment have a better sense of how to take care of yourself before you get home to try to unwind.
Right. Yeah,
the breathing, I can see it being very useful in a situation that you don't have any control over. That you might say you're at the bottom of the hill and it's all coming down towards you. And many of us have those kinds of situations occur fairly regularly. And you're going to get dumped on, and you know the breathing is probably the best way that I can think of to cope with it.
Yeah, because
concentrate on breathing.
You can control your breathing, and if you realize, oftentimes when we're angry or upset or frustrated, our breathing gets really shallow, our chest tightens up, and if you can just like follow your breath, relax your breath, consciously tell yourself to just be with your breath and relax your breath, sometimes that's very healing, and it helps you remember to relax in the moment instead of getting all tight inside and knotted up, but to be more in the moment. And how do you take care of yourself in the moment? How can you hold on to your sense of dignity? How can you find your personal power if somebody's dumping on you? If getting involved in trying to be hostile to the person, that accelerates the problem. But if you can focus on your relationship with yourself, how can you take care of yourself in that moment? How can you change so that you're putting up a protective shield? Using the breath, it's a Tai Chi technique of being more in power in that moment. It's not just movement, it's like paying attention to your breath. So the more a person is aware in the moment and can like pay attention to how is my breath, that is a key to making everything else work more consciously and you having more control over how you are responding in the moment. So just little things like paying attention to your breath can really help affect what you're experiencing and might make your day a little better.
That's not a little thing. That's a really big thing. Actually, the very first cell in the matrix, which we called cell zero, is about breathing. And practically, almost the vast majority of the rest of the meditative practices throughout the matrix of consciousness all involve some relationship to breathing and are connected with breathing in one way or another.
Well, you know, the breath of life, okay? Breathing is something that, right down to our very core, is absolutely necessary. It is something that we can control, the speed, the depth of breath. We can control it to a degree. And I can see that this breathing technique probably, for me, would be one of the most useful things I could possibly actually work on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you start with breathing, and then you move on to paying attention to your bodily tension, those things alone give you a great foundation. You put them together with physical balance. A lot of people are, we use the term unbalanced as equivalent to crazy. Well, most of us are a little bit unbalanced in our daily lives. So we have a number of practices that are designed to help a person be more balanced. So you have balance, you have breathing, you have letting go of physical tension, and then it becomes possible to take what you've done in those very physical ways into the mental and emotional realms. As you you point out, not overnight, gradually, bit by bit, but it does become possible, and you can take what you've done with those three things, and they begin to transform the way you think and the way you react emotionally as well.
Yeah, because, again, those three things provide a foundation that you can build on, and controlling your own emotional response gives you control of the situation. Yeah. Yeah, when I said, when these people that aggravated me so much, that it was really my problem, well, it was because it was my emotional response that was causing me the problem. Mm-hmm. They don't care how I feel, or they wouldn't act like that. Go ahead.
There's another thing in relationship to getting aggravated with people that tends to be extremely pervasive, and that's the desire to be right. I'm right and you're wrong. Those stupid sons of bitches, how can they say that? And so we all want to be right, and the desire to be right becomes very compelling and very aggravating. One of my own teachers, his name was Red Thomas, actually, he just dropped his body not too long ago. Spent a lot of time with Carl Rogers, who was one of the great psychologists of our time. And he said, an interesting thing about Carl is that in all the time I spent with him, I almost never heard him argue. So what Rogers did was he formulated the principle of an internal frame of reference. So instead of responding, this is so, this isn't so, or you're right, you're wrong, he tried to come from his own place. I like this, I don't like this, I don't agree. And it's very hard for somebody else to argue with that. So you stepping outside of the arguments and stepping outside of the, for me personally, I used to be very, very heavily into the I want to be right thing. And I would get into lots of arguments about this and that until one day a friend of mine said, you know, Victor, you really don't like to be contradicted, do you? Bang, what a blow. I had viewed myself as so open-minded, so willing to consider anything. And at that moment, in the context of that conversation, it was totally obvious that she was absolutely 100% correct. I did not like to be contradicted. And so I found it really useful personally to introduce the phrase, of course I may be wrong about this, into my vocabulary, and to use it frequently, and to attempt to, Cooch actually does a better job, I think, of saying I like and I don't like than coming from an internal frame of reference than I do. But it's a great practice. I'll sometimes reverse myself. I'll say something is or isn't so, and then I'll step back to stating it from my own viewpoint. And people can't argue with that, and sometimes then they'll pick up on it and start going to the same kind of place, and that leads to a gentler kind of dialogue than the shouting, red-faced fist pound of an argument.
The arguing over who's right thing, really, especially when you're dealing with something intangible, it's not over, is this 3 inches tall or 3.5 inches tall? It's over something, which shade of gray is it? And there's nobody that's really going to be right or wrong or whatever.
Right, is this restaurant better than that one? The right wrong is, it's one of the biggest sources of problems that couples have, one of the biggest sources of trouble in marriage. Right and wrong, it becomes a power struggle. Who wins? I need to be right.
So you look at it as world politics, and a lot of it is a religion base, and that's my religion's right and yours is wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
And why does it have to be somebody's right and somebody's wrong? I like this and you like that. That's fine,
Go ahead, Cooch.
I was going to say that it's beyond logic, because we get emotionally attached to our feelings of being right. even if you're talking about your religion is right, people feel it on an emotional level, and no one wants to be contradicted on an emotional level because our emotions are so deep. So when we're arguing about who's right, it's beyond logic, and sometimes it makes absolutely no sense, and it's not even logical, but it's an emotional response, like what I'm feeling. It's totally on a very deep emotional core, from my emotional core. So who, if you're really strong, stubborn, and willful, it's not going to be easy to accept that you're wrong.
It's a general principle that when logic and emotion contradict each other, emotion almost always wins.
Yeah, this is true. But hang on to these thoughts, because, folks, it is time for our break. Check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com, while we're away from your computer. And stay tuned, and the Dawn of Shades will be right back with Victor and Peach Daniels. Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, I'd like to remind everyone to visit the website, www.exogenynetwork.com, and sign up for the newsletter. Wander around, explore the website. Let me know what you think of it. There are links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you have a question about the program tonight that you wish to have asked, you can email it to me at giascott@gmail.com. I'm monitoring the email during the program. Those of you in the virtual auditorium can put them in text, too. And Victor and Cooch, before we start talking and forget, please give the information about your book and your website for everyone in the audience.
Victor?
Okay. It's the book is called Matrix Meditations, a 16-week program for developing the mind-heart connection. And it's a systematic guide to meditation for everyone from beginners to advanced meditators. And it also offers invaluable insights and a framework for a person really to contemplate their life and contemplate what's important to them, whether or not they maintain a formal meditation practice. It's designed for people from any religious orientation or none. It draws on spiritual traditions from all over the world. And the website at which you can read a couple of chapters and read the introduction and the table of contents is http://www.matrixmeditations.com/. And it's all one word, all lowercase. But if you forget that, all you have to do is go to Google or Yahoo and put in the words Matrix Meditations as a couple of words or as one word either way, and it'll take you right to the website, and that'll bring you to the home page, and over on the right side are a whole lot of different links about different kinds of applications, about the book, about its benefits, etc., and about any events that we'll be doing. That's Matrix
Meditation. And for those of you who are out there, I bet you can also get this book at Amazon too, can't you?
Oh, you can get it at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at, there's a dozen online booksellers that carry it. But yes, Amazon is certainly the biggest and best known of them.
Yep, yeah, everybody knows Amazon. And if you're listening tonight wondering whether or not you want to buy this book is set up to be very easy to read. You can read a chapter and set it down and try it out. You know, as we were talking earlier in the first half of the program, you know, they have a lot of things in here for you to just use as a quick fix. And they can be building blocks for later, or you can just stay with, say, the breathing technique or whatever works for you. But it is, you know, I haven't finished reading it. Okay, I will confess that. I did not get it all read. But it is set up for just quick and easy reading. So you don't have to sit down and read the whole thing for it to make sense. Because I do have some books like that. They are very hard to read and they're very dry. And, you know, you have to practically beat yourself to make yourself sit down with a book. This one isn't like that. So I recommend it to everybody. Go out and get Matrix Meditation. And where were we at before we went to break? We were talking about something. I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. In meditation, it's frequently the case that you have something that you focus on and the train of thought comes and it goes. And actually, we recommend that what I often do when I'm meditating is I have a little notebook nearby, and if there's something that comes up as I comes up in kind of the large pool of inner space that meditation creates, if there's something that comes up that I don't want to forget, I write it down in the little book. And one of the things that that's quite interesting is that often in the process of meditation, I will remember something very important that I had not been getting around to that I needed to do, and will do it and avoid considerable trouble, or I will realize that something that I had intended to do, I don't really have to do, or I can do in a much more efficient way. So meditation, actually, the 15 minutes a day or so that a person puts into meditation can actually pay back much more time than that during the course of the day and make life more efficient.
You know, along those efficiency lines, over the years, I've had a haphazard sort of meditation schedule because things seem to just take priority all too often. How can you really get yourself into the routine? And because I do feel better when I do it, and I know I do feel better, but I still tend to put it off because the dishes need doing, or there's an errand to run, or a phone call to make, or some article needs written, or I need to work on the website, or one of 4 million things I need doing on any day, and those always take priority. So how can you ensure that you give enough priority to the meditation?
Well, there's two things. One that I say is promise yourself that you'll sit down to meditate for at least 5 minutes. Now, 5 minutes isn't long. You may think, oh, I can't spare 15 or 20 minutes, but you can probably spare five. And my experience is that usually if I sit down and I promise that I'm going to meditate for 5 minutes, I will usually, at the end of that 5 minutes, want to stay there and want to keep on meditating for a longer period of time. But I don't have to. I can get up. So that's one thing, is to make a smaller initial demand on yourself. A different approach is for there to be something that you customarily do, that you do a lot of, and that you do around the time that you meditate, and to make a contract with yourself that you're not going to let yourself do that other thing until you have first meditated for whatever period of time it is that you choose. So you're using the in psychologies, you use the opportunity to engage in a high probability behavior, that is whatever else it is that you usually do, as a reward for spending a little time in a lower probability behavior, which is meditation, and that brings up the probability that you meditate.
And I have something to add to this, which is that if you're really busy and you need to be doing something, you can do an active meditation. You might, if you're doing an art project that needs to be done, or say you're writing articles. So approach it with awareness. Pay attention to your breath. You can even do a mantra meditation or a positive affirmation where you say something very healing to your inner self. And what you are doing that needs to be done in the outer world becomes an active meditation, so you're doing it more from a quiet, reflective inward awareness point of view way of doing it, and it almost becomes a moving meditation. So you go, I'm too busy, I can't stop. Well, if you're not going to stop, can you at least slow down enough to try to bring yourself into the moment and have a meditative, reflective time with some little aspect of what you're doing? It can make all the difference between like hurrying up and rushing through the experience and not even noticing what you're doing because you're doing it so fast, and it, with becoming more conscious, more tuned into what you need to feel good in that moment, and to be able to almost be in a meditative state, which is more calm and reflective, and it can be a valuable moment even if you're not stopping from what you have to do.
Let me give you an example of a particular brief everyday awareness meditating in action that does exist, just described. This one is in cell number 12, which is titled Choice, Pathways, Preferences, and Self-Determination. And the title of the meditation, each of these meditations, each of the 65 meditations has a title. This one is called Narrating Your Actions. And I'll just read two very brief little paragraphs here.
Are they really brief? Because people don't like being read to, I don't think, that much.
Oh, they're really brief.
Okay, go ahead.
Choose a physical activity that involves moving and performing some action. As you carry it out, silently report your activity to yourself. Now I am walking across the kitchen floor. Now I am reaching up and getting a glass from the shelf. I am placing it beneath the faucet. I am turning on the cold water tap, so that you're actually doing whatever you do, but you are describing out loud or quietly to yourself what you do as you do it. And then each time you notice that you're acting mindlessly, you notice that you realize that your mind has drifted off and you're no longer narrating what you're doing, let go of those other thoughts and return your attention to describing what you do as you do it. This can very quickly bring you from being in a scattered state of mind into focusing and into being present as you do what you do.
With our earlier conversation, when you were talking about either being judgmental or angry or hurt, it's, if you can be in that moment and instead of totally being out of control in the moment, you try to bring your awareness to meditating or reflecting on how am I feeling in my body? Because we sometimes forget our body. We get so caught up in that we're doing something or responding to something that we forget that our body's registering every feeling, every thought on a physical level. So you go, okay, how does that person, what they're saying, where am I registering what I'm feeling in response? Where is it showing up in my body? So you take a moment, it's just a regular moment when you're out doing something and it's stressful or conflictive, or there's a challenge, and you go, you know, how is my body responding in this moment? So we take one moment to just reflect and become totally focused on where am I feeling, what am I feeling in my body in this moment? And it becomes like a moving meditation where you're just trying to tune in and feel with awareness, meditating on what you're sensing and feeling at a physical level. And because we're a physical body, we're an emotional body, we're a mental body, and we're a spiritual body. So you can go through all those different levels. You can, first, where are you feeling something in your physical body? You can do it with every level. You can go, what is the key word that's triggering my annoyance? Or what is the emotion that's being triggered? So you go through the different levels of our being, the physical, emotional, spiritual, or soul energy, our whole being. You go through all the different levels and key in, and that becomes a moving meditation, and it's very profound, and it really keys you into being more conscious, aware, and tuned in with what is happening in that moment. And when you have that, there can be a shift or a transformation because you become more aware. So it's not
that
like, oh, I have to go down.
when I was in like many years ago, I was in French Polynesia, and I was young and I didn't have much money, and I bought a 2-week passage on a coconut boat that went around through the Tuamotu Islands, and I slept on the deck with all of the Polynesians that were there, and we just put our mats out and went through all kinds of heavy storms and so on, and after that couple of weeks, I went back and flew from Tahiti to Auckland, New Zealand, and got out. And Auckland is like practically any big city. It's like San Francisco or New Orleans or anything else. And I got off of the bus at downtown after I'd taken the bus from the airport and walked out and saw the people walking along the sidewalks. And practically, you know, it looked like a group of zombies were walking along with their heads disconnected from their bodies. People would be reading a newspaper or just puttering along, and I could see, just looking at them, their minds were spinning around and around and around. Not everybody, but a great many of the people are spinning around and around with no consciousness of what was going on in their bodies, even though everything that they were thinking and feeling was registering in their bodies. So part of what we try to do throughout this book is connect the body with the mind, with the emotions, with our actions, so that a person becomes a more integrated being rather than sort of divided into little compartments of existence.
And we're not just talking heads, but we have a heart connection with the world. And we feel things on deeper levels, and we have a more meaningful relationship with people, including ourselves.
And that's important. You know, we tend to get very superficial about things. Everything is, you know, it's temporary, I guess. You know, I watch this, and it's like we have a 30-second attention span.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's presented to us in these sound bites. Television
right.
does that to us. The biggest fad right now on the internet is Twitter with your 140 character statement to the world, and you know your little short statements on the social networking, and we're down to 140 characters, and that's not much. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know we should be a little bit more deeper.
Well, we've expanded that 30-second soundbite into a 4-page reading bite in the Matrix of Consciousness, so that on one hand we decry it in the same way that you just described, and on the other hand, recognizing that that's the way people function a lot these days, we have divided our depth into brief statements. But meditation itself is deep. Meditation takes a person into their depths, into discovering sides of themselves that they won't find in those brief sound bites.
You know, in your title, The Matrix Meditations, you know, most people, when they say Matrix, they immediately think of that movie that came out a few years back.
Right.
You know, and that it's some sort of artificial intelligence controlling our every move.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how are you using Matrix with the title? Could you describe that to the audience?
Sure. We're using the Matrix as essentially, and I'll be honest with you. We know the movie is there. We know people have seen the movie, and so Matrix is a memorable term. It's something that's easy to remember. We could have called the thing the grid of consciousness. If you look on page 5, you see the Matrix of consciousness, and it shows all of the different areas of life that are in the different cells: forgiveness, confusion, strength, hang up, healing, joys, just referring to a number of them. So we have this
uh-huh.
we have this chart. We could have called it the chart of consciousness, the grid of consciousness. You know, pick a word. Matrix seemed to be one that would be both more had a little more pizzazz to it, a little more feeling, and a little more memorableness to it. So we called it the Matrix of consciousness.
But Matrix is the source. It's like the source of our consciousness. It's what holds everything together. It's like if you can get to the center of the point, if you can get to the Matrix, then you are in touch with everything. You have more of a connection with everyone else as well, because the matrix holds everything together. It's like the mother, it's the source, it's the connecting
point. Well, I can see that very easily, because a matrix is something to build on. It's a framework. You know, that's what it means to me. It's this framework that things can be built on, whether it's a matrix that's been put in place for cells to build themselves on and rebuild damaged tissue. You know, and that's you know, it's that framework that things are built on. And so it does make a lot of sense to me.
And a matrix also connects, and so does the meditative framework that we put together, both in terms of we've got meditations that deal with our connectedness to others, like contemplative meditations that are oriented towards such things as forgiveness, tolerance, gratitude, apology. Each one of those is the name of a cell. Generosity, unity. So those are all about ways in which we connect with other people in our natural world. And we've also got awareness activities that actively embody connection, such as intuition, listening, communication, judgment. Well, judgment can be toward other people or toward yourself. So we're the approach to meditation that we have developed here includes both going inward and then also from that inward place connecting with others in a way that is somehow different and more enriching and more loving and more rewarding in the ways in which you have connected with people in the past.
I just grabbed the dictionary and I had to look it up because I went, oh, I haven't even looked it up in the dictionary. But the original meaning for the matrix is the womb, the uterus, hence that from which or from within which something originates, takes forms, and develops. So I think the matrix is kind of like it's what holds everything together. It creates the womb for us to go come out of, actually, and to be reborn into being stronger and wiser and more in touch with the potential that lives within us.
That's fascinating. I think you can do a little blog on that and put it on the website, on the blog section.
I think that's probably a good idea. Now we can just
The website is brand new, and there's hardly anything on the blog section, so that sounds like a good thing to put in it.
Well, it is an interesting, actually, I've never looked up the word either, but, to actually know the definition, it does kind of shift one's perception a little bit.
Uterus, especially. That within which something takes form, it provides a kind of a perfect sort of conceptual container for what we were trying to do.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I like the word mother too.
Well, that kind of goes hand in hand with the uterus and womb sort of concept as well, because they're all sort of the same thing.
Yeah, it gives life. It's the miracle of life.
Takes us back to beginnings. One of our own principal meditation teachers was Jakusho Kwang Roshi, and his teacher Shunryu Suzuki, who came over from Japan, wrote a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I remember approximately the line from it: in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind there are few. Now, I don't always agree with him. I think, if you're playing the guitar, for instance, the expert who has mastered many techniques will probably have more possibilities than the beginner. But in everyday life, I think it's a very good statement. And in a sense, womb and uterus refer to beginnings and beginner's mind.
Yeah.
If you begin every day fresh and new, anything is possible. If you wake up and you've already got it all planned out, then you might not see what's really available in front of you in the moment.
And we tend to live so much of our lives locked into past old patterns. I mean, in psychology, that's one of the psychology and psychotherapy. That's one of the central tasks is to help people become aware of the patterns of which they're unconscious. Right? Often just doing things without realizing that they're doing them, and that can be in action, in attitudes, and beliefs, and anything else. So becoming aware of those entrenched old patterns and being able to make a new beginning. We actually have, I think, a starting point. What's it called? New beginnings? Something like that.
Yeah.
That sounds like you've been doing that in New Orleans too. That, in a sense, after the storm, that you've been making your own new beginnings there. Are there events or things that are happening in New Orleans that in some way are new and different than the kinds of things that happened before?
Oh, in many, many small ways. Many businesses went away that had been here a long time, but in their place, new ones have come. Many communities were destroyed. But as they're gone, but like we have the Musicians Village that didn't exist before. So you're seeing some things going away and some new things coming in to replace them. And it's interesting to watch a city go through such a major transformation because it is different. It's faster than you would ever see normally. And you're seeing the demographics change, and it'll be really interesting to see we're 4 years past the storm now, say what another 6 years, put it 10 years past it, mm-hmm. what exactly New Orleans will be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in the interim, you always have growing pains, and
yeah.
So it will be interesting to see what the next few years bring.
I'm looking here at the cell I was referring to, cell 6. The title is Renewal, and the subtitle is Endings and New Beginnings. And we have a quotation from Robert Frost to begin the cell. In 3 words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on. And there's so much of life that does involve endings and new beginnings. Things come to an end and other things start. On the other hand, we try and we tend to keep things as they are. And if we keep things too much as they are, then we lose out on a lot of the adventures that can open up to us.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, loss and renewal and everything is so hard for us to deal with, accept, just move on with. And so, you know, I watched a lot of people that couldn't adjust. And, you know, that's been very tough, too.
Mm-hmm.
You want things the way they were. Well, you can't go back in time. I'm sorry. And so you have to adapt to what is now. And it's not easy for some people. Some people have a much harder time than the average person does.
Can you think of an example of somebody who hasn't been able to adapt to the changes and how they've responded?
Well, unfortunately, here in New Orleans, it's often resulted in suicide.
So we had
a much higher rate after the storm. I think it's leveled out. They actually have advertisements on talking to your neighbors, see if they need anything. Here's a helpline, okay, and that runs on the radio still. And because it was a problem. People did suffer from depression, and people did choose that particular solution, you might say, to dealing with change. They just could not adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Elderly people frequently could not adapt, and it wasn't as dramatic as suicide, but they would go into a decline that ultimately would result in their death. So that's the worst-case scenario. You know, and that's unfortunate. And, you know, whether or not it could be prevented, you know, that we could debate that until the cows come home, you know. and, you know, who's going to be right, who's going to be wrong, I don't know. But, yeah, that, you know, that is something that did happen. And sometimes, I think that the long-term dislocation that people felt, because a lot of people couldn't come home for 6 months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even then they were coming home to a destroyed house and still had to deal with those issues. So, yeah, there was a lot of stuff went on. But, you know, so, yeah, that's the worst-case scenario, with not being able to adapt to change.
And for some people, the dislocations were permanent. The person who delivers the newspapers out here in the Pacific Coast, north of San Francisco, in the little town where we live, was a refugee from Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah. Well, you think about it. If you can't come home for a year, what are you going to do? You're going to find a job. You're going to find a place to live. You're going to put your kids in school. You're going to start a life.
Yeah.
You cannot live in limbo that long. So the logical thing is, I was lucky. I came home a month after the storm.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
Was your home okay?
Oh, yeah. I happen to live where I live. Didn't flood. It's on natural dry land. Didn't flood. My house wasn't damaged much. The tree that fell on it broke apart before it fell on it, so just a few shingles. And I actually had more damage from Gustav last year than I did from Katrina.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you were fortunate.
Oh. Yeah, you know. Probably for me, the biggest problem was, A, I was in northeast Texas, a long ways from home, and, you know, not working for a month. You know, because for most people, that's taking a month off, that's a huge financial surprise.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, too bad you didn't have Matrix Meditations with you at the time. If we'd finished it by then, and you'd have something to do for the month.
Well, you know, it was a stressful time, because a lot of people don't realize how inaccurate the information was that you were getting. So you're getting information that's not accurate, and you're pretty much presented with a worst-case scenario, that everything in New Orleans is just gone, destroyed. Everything's underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're kind of going, you're just in shock, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, what am I going to do? And you don't know, because your whole world has just been rocked.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then you find out, well, no, not everything's been destroyed. So then you're in limbo. Will I be able to go home, or will I not be able to go home?
Mm-hmm.
And
will I have a home to go to?
Will I have a reason to go back? Will I have a job? Will there be services there? Am I better off to relocate now? You know, since I'm already gone, you know, should I just find a job and a place to live now? You know, what should I do? So you have so many decisions that weren't on your plate, you know, that Sunday morning when I left, that suddenly on Tuesday night, or Monday night actually, are suddenly, you know, looking like probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm going to have to move and change jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the turmoil for the period of time when you didn't know, can I come back? When can I come back? Will I have a job? Well, you know, what's going to be going on? Because you couldn't get accurate information.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
In a large realm of uncertainty there.
Yeah, you know, because you can't make decisions without information.
Yeah.
You know, and you couldn't decide, should I relocate, because you didn't know, do I have a job, do I have a reason to go back? Is the house even still standing? You know, none of that was known.
Do you have any idea what proportion of the original population of New Orleans it has now? Is it like three-quarters as many, or nine-tenths, or half?
I'm not real sure on that. I wouldn't know for sure. I'm thinking that I had heard recently that it was three-quarters,
mm-hmm.
but I could be very wrong. So, you know, there's still areas in East New Orleans that are vacant. you know, and cause East New Orleans was severely damaged. A lot of the areas are coming back. Sometimes it's one house on the block that used to have 12 or 15 houses. And so, you know, it's sometimes spotty and imperfect, but, you know, it's a growing
and
phase,
part of the
I guess,
challenge
I might say.
In that case, then, becomes for people to realize internally that, hey, this is something that happened outside me. This is not my doing. And, you know, it's the other side of taking responsibility. It's recognizing that, hey, I don't need to blame myself for something that I'm not responsible for.
Well, really, that's something that anybody who is ever the victim of anything needs to realize. I'm not responsible for that. It's not my fault. I couldn't do anything about it. And I need to just let it go.
Yeah. And that's
let
hard
it go
for
and
somebody
move on.
Who's grown up being told that, especially if you get someone who's been blamed for everything as they were growing up, they're likely to blame themselves even for things that aren't their own fault.
Well, you know, I'm bad about that, too. I was the oldest in the family, and if my younger siblings did anything wrong, it was my fault. I should have prevented it. So it took me a while, you know, to learn. I don't have to be responsible for everybody all the time. And, you know, it is something that you do have to learn. Just because somebody chooses to act like an idiot is not my fault, and they have the free will to do so. And so that sometimes can be, you know, a tough decision that you just have to let them do their thing. You can tell them, I don't agree with it, I think it's wrong, and I think you can make better choices, but it's still not your fault.
Yeah.
And that's a tough one to learn to deal with, especially if you're dealing with somebody who has become a drug addict. And in the past, I've had some friends that's the choices that they made. And it was hard to watch them destroying themselves and really not be able to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't live for other people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one. Gooch, have you got any input at this point?
Well, I was just thinking about people who have addictions because... thinking of any kind of addictions, mental addictions, but physical addictions like drugs or alcohol, and thinking that meditation is a way to, it's one more handle to have more awareness about involvements of things that you get trapped into that have physical, you know, they take over our bodies. So I was just thinking of the word addiction when I heard the word addiction.
It can also be a way to help move out of addiction, because one of the things that the drugs do is they provide an altered state of consciousness, and meditation is another way of moving into an altered state of consciousness that also, in many cases, feels better than ordinary everyday consciousness, so that some people have used meditation successfully in helping themselves move out of whatever kind of addiction they had been in.
Well, and I don't know, sometimes I think addiction is a disconnect. They're using the drugs to disconnect themselves.
Sure.
And, you know, the meditation perhaps is a way for them to safely reintegrate a connection with themselves again.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you have to have.
Exactly. I think about the sociological term alienation. And that often many of the people who have gone into misusing drugs feel alienated from their society. They feel like somehow they're not related to it, or you're disconnected from it. I like that disconnection. And so.
I have to admit, when I'm people watching, looking at them, I'm thinking, oh please, let me be another species.
Yeah. And then there's also the
go ahead.
There's also, also the thing of watching people who are not communicating well, who are disconnected from each other, and it's as though you know what they're saying is on like just sort of sliding past each other. But each person responds in terms of their own interests, and the other person responds in terms of their interests, and never the twain shall meet. It's as though they're having a pretense of a conversation without ever really talking to each other.
Well, you know, I think about that image and, you know, seeing a crowded nightclub or a crowd on Bourbon Street or whatever, where people are all mixed together and they're in close quarters. They're all disconnected. They're all absolutely and totally alone.
Uh-huh.
When you watch
yeah.
them, just sit and watch them in this crowd. You know, they're milling around and yet there's no connection between any of them. And I find people watching happens to be a hobby of mine, obviously. And I
yeah.
find watching them when they're doing that to be very curious, because it's like, why do you want to be down there in that herd and then act like that? You know, and I do sometimes wonder why people do the things they do, you know, but as you're watching them, along with the thoughts of, I hope I'm another species, it's like, why are they doing that? And, you know, they're all alone.
Well,
They're all alone. One
of the reasons people do it is because everybody says that it's the thing to do.
I suppose so.
And then also, I guess there is the, even if people aren't really connecting, that being surrounded by other people and not connecting may feel better than being all alone if they haven't learned to enjoy their own company and be alone.
But maybe people are looking for love. They're out there trying to find somebody to hug them at night, or you know, to have somebody to hold on to. So they might be sitting there all alone, but they're definitely looking for love. I think a lot of people are out in the world looking for love and trying to find that. So that makes a lot of
yeah.
us go out and do things that otherwise we'd be staying home watching television.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a hot date out there. Somebody for me somewhere.
The person
the dates can drive you. Pardon?
No, go ahead.
Well, the dates do drive you to go out. I'm engaged now, but I was single most of my life. And I've had some very strange dates over the years, and I have tried things that I probably wouldn't have tried otherwise. Some of them, you know, I thought were interesting and experiments, and others I thought, what am I doing here? And the nightclub thing quickly fell on my list of least favorite things to do. And it was you watch people. Go ahead.
You didn't meet your lover at a bar, then, it sounds like.
Pardon?
It sounds like you didn't meet your fiancé at a bar.
No, actually, we had known each other and been very good friends for a very, very long time. And it compared notes, right down to the point of comparing notes on failed relationships along the way. So,
wow.
You know, we've been best friends a long time. So, yeah.
Well, that's good. I would say that's a good prognosis for a successful future relationship.
Yeah, we've been engaged a little over a year now. One of these days we'll get around to actually getting married, but I actually announced it to the world on this particular show.
Wow!
Last year. Yeah. It was kind of a dare thing, and yeah, I did. I announced it on the show, and that's actually how my mother even found out.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
So, I got a number of phone calls the next day, and so it was kind of amusing, but I had gotten engaged earlier that day, and then I said so on the show, and that was how everybody found out, was from the radio show. So, yeah.
Are you going to have your wedding broadcast live?
A little bit of trivia. Pardon?
Are you going to have your wedding broadcast live?
That's a good idea.
Probably not. Well, yeah, but at the same time, the logistics of trying to broadcast a wedding can get a little difficult. We'll see. Maybe we will.
There's always
it would
YouTube.
Be something different.
Yeah,
well,
there
if it
is
works,
always
it was, if it works, it was my idea, and if it doesn't, I have nothing to do with it.
Okay. That sounds fair enough to me. You know, we've only got a couple of minutes left in the show already.
Wow, we went fast.
It's been
fun. I'd like to bring up one thing. We're talking about people's interests. I have your audience has an interest in the paranormal. We have one meditation in the cell called Intuition that teaches people how to develop their psychic abilities. I just wanted to put that in there for the people who like to do psychic things or develop their intuition.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a useful thing. Developing your intuition can be useful in your day-to-day life, even if you don't want to become the next whatever famous psychic there is. I can't think of a name right now. But, you know, just developing your intuition. Pardon?
Yeah, well-developed intuition can help people not make a lot of bad mistakes and can help them do things that lead to great adventures that they otherwise never would have been led to.
You know, I found that intuition has led me into some of the best wildest times of my life. The so-called wrong turns, you know, when all of a sudden you said, I'm going to turn here. And, you know, made a right-hand turn on when life said you should go straight. And, you know, it's been great. And I find that intuition has always led to the best adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Albert Einstein said that that his greatest discoveries were due to intuition rather than logic.
Well, I think he was probably right. Before we have to go to the closing, though, you guys have any last-minute thoughts, and then mention your website one more time?
Sure. That's Google or Yahoo Matrix Meditations, and look for Matrix Meditations by Victor Daniels and Cooch N. Daniels, and the website has all the additional information a person might want about the book. We encourage you to patronize your local bookstores and pick the book up there, column it and hold it for you if they don't have it, or if you'd rather buy online, it's there at Amazon or at any other online bookseller. And I'll just say one thing. I have one friend that looked at this not long ago, and he said, you know, the old story about if I was going to be on a desert island and I could only choose one book to take with me, this is a great candidate. It's a wonderful book that's not just a read, but it's something that I'm going to live with for the rest of my life.
Hey, and I'd like to bring up my personal website, which is www.cybermystic.com. And it's also on cybermist.com. It talks about the other book that we've written together, which is called Tarot de Amor. So I want to put my little plug in for that as well as the Matrix Meditations.
Okay. And if you can't remember all that, if you go to Exogeny Network, if you look for Victor and Cooch Daniels on Madonna Shades, you can see they have a page there with information about them and links to take you to their website and information about the book. So, with that, folks, we are out of time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I have enjoyed this a great deal, and you've been fantastic guests. I hope the audience has enjoyed it as much as I have, as well as having found that it provided plenty of food for thought with more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we bring you Jim Mars, author of a long list of books, including The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and another fascinating episode of The Dawn of Shades. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.